Good morning, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode for the duration of today's conference. I would like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to your host today, Ms. Linda Feinberg. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Welcome. I'm Linda Feinberg, President of NASD Dispute Resolution. Thank you for participating in this, our sixth call-in workshop. Audio recordings of our workshops are available on our website at www.nasd.com under Resources for Neutrals. MCI will offer a recording of today's workshop for the next 30 days. A recording will then be exclusively available on our website. On January 24 of this year, the SEC approved extensive revisions to the NASD Code of Arbitration Procedure. Separately, on January 3rd, the Commission approved new rules governing the issuance of third-party subpoenas. In today's workshop, Rick Berry and I will cover both of these areas. For those of you who may not be familiar with this code revision project, we began the process of revising the old code soon after the SEC launched its Plain English initiative in 1998, under which the SEC encouraged public companies and regulators to use plain English in materials used by investors. The initiative recommended that documents use shorter sentences and more common words, break long rules into shorter ones, use the active voice whenever possible, and put lists into easy-to-read formatting, such as bullet points. In response, we undertook to rewrite the old code in plain English. During the course of rewriting, the goals of our Plain English initiative expanded to include structural and substantive changes. While revising the old code, we reorganized the provisions in a more logical, user-friendly way, including creating separate codes for customer and industry arbitrations and a separate code for the mediation rules. One of the most frequent criticisms of the old code was that it was poorly organized. Parties, particularly infrequent users of the forum, had difficulty finding the rules they were looking for because they were not in the order of an arbitration case, and the titles were not always informative. The confusion was increased because certain rules in the code applied only to customer cases, others only to industry cases, and many to both. To fix this, we reorganized the old code into three separate codes, the customer, industry, and mediation code. As I mentioned, the SEC approved the customer and industry codes on January 24. The mediation code had previously been approved on October 31 of 2005 and became effective on January 30, 2006. Most of the new code provisions will become effective on Monday, April 16. We will discuss the effective dates at the end of the workshop. Most rules of the new customer and industry codes are identical. Exceptions include panel composition, references to document production lists that apply only in customer cases, and rules relating to employment discrimination and injunctive relief that apply only to industry claims. Wherever possible, the last three digits of the rule numbers in the customer and industry codes are the same. For example, under the customer code, the rule governing payment of arbitrators is Rule 12214. Under the industry code, the same rule is Rule 13214. During this workshop, If we provide two rule numbers when discussing an issue, the first will refer to a provision in the customer code, the second to a provision in the industry code. Also, the new codes have been organized in a manner that approximates the chronological order of a typical arbitration proceeding. To further assist arbitrators and parties, we have added a table of contents as well as a definitions rule that defines commonly used terms applicable throughout the new code. The definitions rule in the customer code is Rule 12-100. In the industry code, it is Rule 13-100. In addition to reorganizing the old code, we also decided to implement several substantive rule changes, including codifying several current practices in our forum that were not included in the old code. Our goal in codifying these practices was to provide more guidance to arbitrators and parties on procedures that have become routine. Some of the new rules codifying current practices include a motions practice rule, Rules 12-503 and 13-503, which I will address later in the call. An ex parte rule, 12-210 and 13-210, based on general ex parte rules applicable in court proceedings and reflecting current NASD practice. The arbitrator's manual and NASD arbitrator training materials direct arbitrators to avoid ex parte communications with parties, and arbitrators receive training on how and why to do so. However, the old code did not address ex parte communications. To provide additional guidance to arbitrators and parties, the new codes expressly prohibit ex parte communication between parties and arbitrators. A sanctions rule, Rules 12-212 and 13-212, that codifies the sanction options available to arbitrators that are currently described in the discovery guide and extends them beyond the discovery context to apply to noncompliance with any order of the panel or provision of the new code. The rule also allows the panel to dismiss a claim under the same conditions as they could under the old code. We believe that this rule will encourage parties to comply with both the code and with orders of the panel, and will also clarify the authority of arbitrators to ensure fair and efficient arbitration proceedings when parties fail to comply with the rules or the orders of the panel. A hearing locations rule for customer disputes, which codifies current NASD practice of generally selecting the NASD hearing location closest to the customer's residence at the time of the events giving rise to the dispute. That is Rule 12-213. For industry disputes involving an associated person, we generally will select the hearing location closest to where the associated person was employed at the time of the events giving rise to the dispute. That is Rule 13-213. An initial pre-hearing conference rule, Rules 12-500 and 13-500, which provides that initial pre-hearing conferences, or, as you're all familiar with them, IPHCs, will be held in every case unless the parties jointly agree on certain scheduling and other enumerated issues in advance. Users of our forum have found the IPHC to be a valuable tool in managing the administration of arbitration. The new rule also codifies the portion of the NASD discovery guide relating to IPHCs. We believe the new rule will provide valuable guidance to parties and arbitrators about the role of IPHCs. And finally, a rule expressly permitting the attendance of expert witnesses at all hearings, Rules 12602 and 13602. In addition, the panel has the discretion to allow other persons to attend the hearing, such as an individual assisting an elderly or disabled party. The panel also has the discretion to bar someone who may be disruptive to the proceeding. I'm now going to turn the microphone over to my colleague Rick Berry, Vice President for Case Administration, who will discuss the most important substantive changes in the new code. Rick?
Thank you, Linda. The new code implements some important changes to NASD rules. These changes streamline and simplify the arbitration process. Today, I'll be focusing in on arbitrator selection, discovery, and amending pleadings to add parties. Let's get started with arbitrator selection. We've dramatically improved how panels are appointed. We've changed chairperson selection and the ranking and striking process. We've also moved from appointing arbitrators on a rotational to a random basis. Let's start with chairperson selection. One thing I've learned in my years here at NASD is that chairpersons play a vital role in the administration of our cases. Under the old code, once the parties received the names of their three arbitrators, we would give them time to agree on which arbitrator should be the chairperson. About 80% of the time, they could not agree on who should be the chair. If they couldn't agree, we appointed the highest-ranked public arbitrator. The arbitrator selected to be chair could be a brand new arbitrator serving on his or her first case. That arbitrator may not have had chairperson training. Bottom line, the old code method of arbitrator selection needed to be improved. The new code created a chairperson roster. You may have already been notified that you are chair qualified. For those of you who wish to become chair qualified, what are the qualifications? To be a chair, you must have completed chairperson training. You also must have completed several cases to award. For those of you with a law degree and membership in a bar of at least one jurisdiction, you need to have served on two cases that went to award. For the non-attorneys, you need to have served on three cases that went to award. If you are chair qualified, you are eligible to appear on the chair and the non-chair list. Of course, you can only appear on one list in a particular case. Another big improvement to arbitrator selection involves the arbitrator ranking and striking process. Under the old code, in a public customer case, parties were given 10 public names and 5 non-public names. Parties had unlimited strikes on the arbitrator list. And guess what? They used them. Parties used so many strikes that in many cases, no arbitrators were left on the list. As you can imagine, after spending so much time reviewing the arbitrator's disclosure list and ranking and striking, parties became frustrated when they got their list of 3 arbitrators, none of whom were on the initial list. The new code improved the ranking and striking process dramatically. I'm going to give you a hint how to remember the new rules. 8, 8, and 8, and 4, 4, and 4. In the new code, in a 3 arbitrator public customer case, the parties will get 8 public chairs, 8 public arbitrators, and 8 non-public arbitrators on the 3 lists. This means we are providing 24 total names under the new code compared to 15 names under the old code. This benefits arbitrators and parties. Arbitrators' names will appear on lists more often, and the parties will have a greater selection of arbitrators to select from. Each separately represented party will get 4 strikes per list, hence the 4, 4, and 4. So if Joe Counsel is representing 2 claimants in a case, he can use four strikes on the public chair list, four strikes on the public list, and four strikes on the non-public list. If Brian Litigator represents three respondents, he can use four strikes per list. We believe the new list selection rules will significantly reduce the number of cases in which we have to appoint arbitrators that were not ranked by the parties. There's one final change to the arbitrator selection process. We've moved from rotational to random appointment of arbitrators. The shift from rotational to random was made to provide arbitrators with an equal opportunity of being listed on any given list of proposed arbitrators, and to simplify the programming of our new matrix computer system. Now I'd like to discuss the important changes we've made to the discovery process. Under the old code, there was no mention of the discovery guide, nor of the document production list, which, as you know, only applies to customer cases. Parties routinely ignored the discovery guideline, which resulted in significant delays in arbitration and required our arbitrators to resolve numerous discovery disputes. We needed to make changes to the old code to make the exchange of documents production lists work better. The new customer code addresses these problems. And we've made your job easier by referencing the document production list in the new customer code. The actual lists are not found in the code, but the new customer code makes clear that the parties are required to take specific action in response to the document production list. Rule 12506 provides that within 60 days from the date that the answer to the statement of claim is due, parties must do one of three things. One, produce documents on the relevant document production list. Two, explain why production is not possible. Or three, object. We've made other improvements that affect both the new customer and industry codes. The new codes include a good faith standard for compliance with the discovery rules, so that failing to comply with discovery provisions or frivolously objecting to production of documents will subject parties to sanctions from the arbitrators. The codes also require parties filing motions to compel to include the disputed document request, a copy of objections to the request, and a description of the efforts of the moving party to resolve the issue before making the motion. Both codes also have specific provisions on interrogatories and depositions. Both codes also expand the time for parties to respond to discovery requests from 30 to 60 days. And finally, both codes have specific discovery sanction rules. While we're on the topic of discovery, I'm going to take a quick break from discussing the new codes to discuss our new subpoena rule. This rule is going into effect on April 2nd. Under our current rules, the parties and the arbitrators have the power of the subpoena process as provided by law. Many disputes arise over the propriety or scope of subpoenas issued by counsel to non-parties. These non-parties don't know if they should respond to the contested subpoena. Under our current rules, the arbitrators are not empowered to maintain effective control of the subpoena process. The new subpoena rule dramatically improves the situation. Under the new rule, only arbitrators may issue subpoenas, whether for discovery or for the appearance of witnesses at a hearing. The chair controls the subpoena process unless he or she involves the entire panel in that decision. Parties will send the request for subpoenas to NESD in the form of a motion and must include a draft subpoena. Opposing counsel will have 10 days to file objections to the motion. The chair decides whether to issue the subpoena and whether to limit its scope. A party receiving documents in response to a subpoena must notify the other party within 5 days of receipt and provide them with copies upon request. The arbitration panel has the authority to determine who should bear the cost of producing the subpoenaed documents. Arbitrators will be paid an honorarium of $200 per case for deciding contested subpoena motions. We think the new code rules and the new subpoena rules will greatly improve the discovery process for both the parties and the arbitrators. Now, my last topic today is the new code rules regarding the amendment of pleadings. Under the old code, parties could be added by amendment without panel approval in such a way that those added parties could be denied a role in panel selection. The new codes provide new protections for newly added parties. Parties cannot be added to a case from the time the arbitrator selection lists are due until a panel is appointed and approves a request to add a party. The new rules also provide any party subject to being added to a case after panel appointments the opportunity to argue that the amendment to add them should be denied. Now, I'm going to turn it back over to Linda to discuss motions to dismiss, fees, effectiveness of the new code provisions, and arbitrator training regarding the new codes.
Thanks, Rick. As I mentioned, the new codes include, as new rules, certain common practices that were not part of the old code. The most significant of these involves motion practice. Motions have become common in NASD arbitration, as all of you know too well, but the old code was silent with respect to them. New rules 12503 and 13503 establish uniform procedures for dealing with motions for the arbitrators and for the parties. The new codes do not expressly address motions to decide claims before a hearing on the merits, so-called dispositive motions. NASD filed a proposal with the SEC in July 2006 to adopt rules 12504 and 13504 to address dispositive motions. In the interim, however, while those proposed rules are pending, rules 12503 and 13503 will govern all motions, including dispositive ones. The one difference between dispositive and all other motions is that a party's response to a dispositive motion will not be due until the panel sets a deadline for that response. This approach is consistent with current practice, which will apply to dispositive motions until decisions are made with respect to the status of the proposed pending rules. Fees. One of the most frequent criticisms of the old code was that fee schedules were difficult to understand, particularly with respect to amounts parties had to pay at the time of filing an arbitration. The fee schedules contain separate columns for a filing fee and a hearing session deposit, and both fees depended on how much the parties claimed as their amounts in dispute. Under the old code, parties paid a non-refundable filing fee and an initial hearing session deposit to start the arbitration process. Some parties had trouble figuring out the total amount they had to pay when filing a claim. Under the new code rules 12900 and 13900, the fee schedules are easier to read and understand. First, we combine the filing fee and the hearing session deposit into a single fee that a party will pay when filing a claim. Second, we condense several sets of fee brackets in the filing fee schedule. There are now fewer fee brackets showing how much a party will pay for claims in each bracket. Thus, the new codes simplify the filing fee schedules with only minor changes to the amounts parties must pay to file a claim. You all may be wondering when the new codes will go into effect and how they will be applied. Shortly after the SEC approved the new codes in January, we published on February 15 Notice to Members 0707 discussing the new codes. With one important exception, these new codes will become effective on Monday, April 16th, just 6 weeks from now, and will apply to all claims filed on or after that date. That is, to all claims filed on or after April 16. However, parties in cases filed before April 16 may stipulate in writing to adopt the new code in its entirety after the April 16 effective date. The one exception to the effective date provision involves the list selection provisions of the new codes. The new list selection provisions will apply to claims filed under the old code, in which a list of arbitrators has not yet been generated and sent to the parties, or in which an entirely new list of arbitrators must be generated. In these cases, even though a list must now be generated under the new code, the claim will continue to be governed by the other provisions of the old code, unless all parties agree in writing to proceed under the new code. And the reason for this exception has to do with our computer programming. Once we turn the switch, so to speak, to the processing under the new code, we cannot process for arbitrator selection under the old system. Once the new codes become effective, we understand that users of the forum may have some difficulty in determining which set of rules to use for a particular case. We will be advising everyone, including arbitrators, to contact your case administrator if you are unsure whether the old or new codes apply to your case. As a reminder, the mediation code was approved in 2005 and became effective on January 30, 2006, after we published Notice to Members 05-85 discussing revisions to that code. We will now amend the mediation code with non-substantive changes to conform the numbering and cross-references to the new customer and industry codes. These changes also will become effective on April 16. For more information on the mediation code, please visit our website. Again, that's www.nasd.com, and click on the Arbitration and Mediation tab. We encourage you to visit our website to read the notices to members, especially 0707 on the new codes, and to download a copy of the three new codes and the comparison charts. These charts are a very valuable tool and provide a section-by-section comparison of each rule change. If you click on the Arbitration and Mediation tab at our website, there will be a link under What's New that will take you to all of the information pertaining to the three new codes. And finally, a few words about arbitrator training on the customer and industry codes before Rick answers some questions that you have emailed to us for today's call-in. We have created a new online course to educate users of our forum about the key changes to the new code. That online training goes into much more depth than the information we are providing in this short call-in. Unlike other online courses that we have offered in the past, this program is designed for all of our constituents, arbitrators, parties, representatives, and staff, to educate them about the fundamental changes in the new code. For arbitrators only, the new code is mandatory and free. We strongly encourage arbitrators on our roster to complete the training course prior to serving on any case filed on or after April 16. The course is available on our website and takes approximately 2 hours to complete. NASD arbitrators will be required to take a short online assessment at the conclusion of this online training. And upon completion, we will automatically update your disclosure report to reflect that you have taken this important course. One note of caution for all of you. Listening in to this call-in or following it on our website after the call-in is over does not substitute for the training, the online training for arbitrators on the new code. That online training is mandatory. And as I said, this call-in does not substitute for taking the online training. And now I will turn the microphone back to Rick for answering some of the questions that you submitted to our workshop previously by email. We will not have any questions during the course of this call-in, but if you have additional questions that were not answered today, you can email or fax them to us after the workshop. And I will give you the details for that after Rick addresses the Q's and A's that you have sent us previously.
The first question we received involves a question about out-of-state attorneys. And here's the question. In general, how should a panel address the appearance of an out-of-state attorney in an NASD arbitration? Under Rules 12-208 and 13-208, all parties have the right to be represented by counsel during any stage of an arbitration. Under the codes, parties may be represented by anyone they choose, including an attorney not licensed in the state in which the hearing is being held. In these cases, the out-of-state attorney will be subject to the laws of the state in which the arbitration is being held, and will be responsible for complying with the rules of the state governing the practice of out-of-state attorneys. In NASD's forum, neither the panel nor the chair is required to raise this issue with the parties or the parties' representatives, unless expressly required by the state where the arbitration is being held. For special rules and procedures relating to arbitrations held in California and Florida, visit our website and review the Arbitrator Reference Guide. We have updated this guide to include a special procedures section for California and Florida cases. If you need more information, call your case administrator in Los Angeles or Boca Raton. The next question asks, should chairpersons be attorneys? The full question says, since NASD hearings are very similar to court litigation with evidentiary rulings, objections, etc., should the NASD require that all chairpersons be lawyers with trial experience or at least have clearly demonstrated through peer review or counsel appraisals an ability to handle the chair's responsibilities? We believe the new codes address these concerns. First, under Rule 12400C, and 13400C, arbitrators are eligible to serve as chairpersons of panels if they have completed chairperson training provided by NASD or have substantially equivalent training or experience. An arbitrator may satisfy this criteria by completing the comprehensive training modules that NASD has developed to test an arbitrator's knowledge of the code and arbitration practices. Second, in addition to having the appropriate level of training or experience to be eligible for the chair, And again, we went over this a little bit earlier, but it's a good review. If the arbitrator is an attorney, they must have a law degree and be a member of a bar of at least one jurisdiction and have served as an arbitrator through award on at least two arbitrations administered by a self-regulatory organization in which hearings were held. Or, for non-attorneys, they must have served as an arbitrator through award on at least three arbitrations administered by a self-regulatory organization in which hearings were held. This requirement is an objective standard that is easily measured, but is not easy to meet. In the time that it takes to serve on three hearings through award, NESD believes that an arbitrator will gain the experience and training required to serve as a chair, even without legal training or experience. Parties may stipulate that their lists of chairpersons contain only arbitrators who are attorneys, and we would honor such a stipulation. The next question asks about chairpersons being included in public and non-public rosters. It states, as a non-public arbitrator who has completed the chairperson's course, does being on the separate chair list remove me from the general list of non-public arbitrators for either arbitrations involving the public or intra-industry arbitrations? The answer is no. As a non-public arbitrator who is eligible for the non-public chair roster, you will also be included in the roster of non-public arbitrators, in other words, the non-chair roster for customer and industry arbitrations. Also note that, under the new rules, arbitrators who are eligible to serve as chairpersons will also be included in the roster of public arbitrators or non-public arbitrators, but will only appear on one list in a case. The next question involves whether we're going to publish hard copies of the new code. And the answer is, we are not going to publish new codes in hard copy. We used to do that a long time ago. We stopped doing so. And the reason is our rules are amended frequently, which makes a hard copy version of the code obsolete shortly after publication. Instead, we believe that the best practice is to update and maintain current versions of our codes on our website. The old code of arbitration procedure and the new codes are available to arbitrators through our website. The versions of the codes that you download and print are the most current available, and you have the option of printing a rule, a section, or the codes in their entirety. The final question asks, right now, I do not have a question about the new codes, but whom should I contact once I begin using the new codes and seek clarification on a new provision in the codes? That's an excellent question, and it's a great way to conclude this portion of our call-in. Should you have a question concerning a provision in the new code, please contact Mignon McLemore, Assistant Chief Counsel of NESD Dispute Resolution, via email. And I will spell this out for you. Email her at mignon.mclemore@nasd.com. Let me do that one more time. It's mignon.mclemore@nasd.com. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Linda to discuss another issue.
Thanks, Rick. As I said, if you have additional questions not answered today, you can email or fax them to us after the workshop. You will have until March 31st to email your question to NASDDRCALL, that's NASDDRCALL-INWORKSHOP@NASD.com. Let me repeat that one more time, NASDDRCALL-INWORKSHOP@NASD.com, or fax them to 1-301-527-4711. And we will answer these questions individually or on our website if they are of general interest. Now, before we conclude, I'd be remiss if I didn't say a word about our consolidation with the New York Stock Exchange regulation and what it may mean for the dispute resolution forum. Last November, NASD and NYSE Group announced a plan to consolidate their member regulation and dispute resolution operations into a single regulatory organization. The new SRO will be responsible for all securities firm regulation, arbitration, and mediation, and for, among other things, overseeing all compliance examinations, rule writing, professional training, licensing, and registration, and industry utilities. And in January this year, following overwhelming board approval, NASD firms voted strongly in favor of the bylaw changes that are necessary for the consolidation to take place. NASD and NYSE regulation have now started the integration process, which of course requires SEC approval of the regulatory changes. The organizations will be consolidated as soon as possible after SEC approval and closing of the transaction. At the current time, we expect the transaction to close during the second quarter of 2007. NASD Chairman and CEO Mary Shapiro will serve as CEO of the new SRO, which has not yet been named. The consolidation will impact NASD's dispute resolution program as well as that of NYSE regulation in a number of ways. First, we are delighted that we will soon be welcoming the excellent staff of NYSE Regulation's Arbitration and Mediation Program. As arbitrators, many of you have worked with these individuals over the years. We will work hard to ensure a seamless integration of the two staffs. Second, we must harmonize the arbitration and mediation rules of the two dispute resolution programs. Using the new NASD codes as our base, we aim to develop a harmonized set of rules that reflect the best of both programs. Third, you may all be wondering what will happen to the cases that are at the New York Stock Exchange and at NASD on the effective date of the consolidation. All NASD cases will continue to proceed under NASD rules with NASD staff. All cases filed at the New York Stock Exchange on or before, before the effective date of the transaction will continue under the existing New York Stock Exchange rules and be processed by existing New York Stock Exchange staff until their completion, that is, through to award and any post-award proceedings that may be necessary. All other cases filed on or after the effective date of the transaction will be processed by NASD staff under existing NASD rules, that is, under the new NASD code. Next, we have already started a review of the best practices and procedures of our two dispute resolution programs. Our aim is simple: to adopt the practices of the two programs that will best serve our constituents. And, of course, of great interest to all of you, we must integrate our two fine rosters of arbitrators and mediators. This will entail meshing our arbitrator and mediator applications, recruitment systems, training programs, and the computer systems we use to maintain our rosters. As to all of those of you who are NASD or joint NASD NYSE arbitrators, you need to do nothing. You will all become part of the harmonized roster of arbitrators who will continue to process all of the new cases that are filed after the transaction closes. And we will review, along with New York Stock Exchange arbitration staff, the roster of NYSE arbitrators to determine whether they have complied and comported with the training and experience requirements that are encompassed in the new NASD code of arbitration. We're already hard at work to meet the challenges of this exciting opportunity to enhance our program. We will provide more details as they emerge through the neutral corner and through future arbitrator call-in programs. You can also keep abreast of the latest developments on consolidation by visiting our website. I know I've said it a lot, but let me repeat it one last time. It's www.nasd.com. Finally, a well-deserved word of thanks to the many NASD and SEC staff who have worked tirelessly over the past 5 years to bring the Code Rewrite Project to a successful conclusion. Special thanks to our Chief Counsel's Office, Jean Feeney, Mignon McLemore, and former staff members of that office, John Nachman and Laura Gansler, as well as to the many other dispute resolution staff who have worked on this fairly massive code project. And we also must thank the staff of SEC's Market Regulation Chief Counsel's Office, all of whom worked so diligently on this project. That concludes today's workshop. We finished early enough so that those of you who are sitting in hearings today will have time to have some lunch. And immediately following today's call, we will send an email containing a link that can be downloaded until April 1st. This link allows you to listen to a free replay of today's workshop. By March 5th, we will also have an audio recording of this workshop available exclusively on our website. Again, thank you for joining us today. We hope you have found our workshop informative.
Thank you. A coordinator will assist you momentarily.